In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms, according to the different propensities of beings. Please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Dadan sem shantam chelo trisudra or zinji lap tu sol. Chalam dudra or zinji lap tu sol. Lam tulpa sour zinji lap tu sol. Trupa yeshe suchawar zinji lap tu sol. I pray for blessing me, my mind, and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing me, the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing me, the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing me, confusion rise as wisdom. Lai ke dang lu dang nu chin ke chuvum da da mi ke nam dang drava kun chi draki jit sambar tam che ke du da ki cha ten. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And the reminder for arousing bodhicitta. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So last week, Lama Jinzong led us through the, we're going to do the meditation, this is just the intro. Lama Jinzong led us through the sufferings of samsara in some detail. And that is one of the antidotes. It's the first antidote to the second obstacle to awakening. We'll talk more about those after the meditation. And karma is also the second of two antidotes to the suffering of samsara. So these two chapters are really interrelated. And when we're studying karma and contemplating karma, it's good to keep in mind why we're doing it, which is to avoid getting stuck in one of the six realms, especially the lower realms. So these are the antidotes to basically to laziness, to using our time for our spare time for pleasure and distraction and not making any time for Dharma practice. So what we're going to do today is the same meditation that we did last week, the same guided meditation. perhaps a little more meditation and a little fewer words, but we're going to contemplate once again Taranatha's descriptions of the suffering of each of the six realms. And bearing in mind that many teachers, all teachers, you know, from Trungpa Rinpoche, Mingyur Rinpoche, Pema Chidrin, remind us that these also refer to psychological states, which we are very familiar with, all of them. So we can remember that they're psychological states, but the contemplation today is to have compassion, to really generate compassion for beings who are stuck in these realms, psychological or physical, like whether they're, you know, really the way that they're being described here, or whether it's really just a description of psychological states. They feel really terrible in the low case of the low realms and deceptively good in the highest realms. So we're going to do taking and sending again for each of the six realms. So bringing our minds to rest, following the breath, or just resting in open awareness. Following the format of the Two Wings of Awakening, we'll remind ourselves briefly of the four thoughts that turn the mind towards the Dharma, which is the purpose of the contemplation. First, appreciating that what we have is a precious human existence. It has its suffering, but it's the best place to be as a launch pad for awakening. So really appreciating this opportunity that we have in this lifetime. And remembering that it's going to end and we don't know when that will be. It could be any minute now. So we may have things that need to occupy our attention other than Dharma practice, but we don't want to get too lost in distraction and fun things when we do have time. Thirdly, today's topic, remembering the law of karma, that it's our actions in this lifetime that determine what will happen to us next. And then fourthly, reminding ourselves that there's no point in just trying to get a better samsaric experience, but we need to really focus on liberating ourselves from the whole thing because it's all suffering, as we learned in the last two classes. And now inviting the blessing of the Lama or the Buddha, visualizing them above the crown of our head, radiating light, love, compassion, awakening, in a body of light on a lotus and moon seat, with or without words, requesting their blessing to follow in their footsteps on this path to awakening and attain what they have attained. And through their compassion and love, that blessing is granted. We receive the blessing, we receive that empowerment for our own practice, and then the visualization descends through the crown of our head and comes to rest in our heart center, where it stays with us, radiating love, compassion, bodhicitta, and awakening. And now taking a moment to just tune in with our basic nature, flashing openness as Trungpa Rinpoche and Pema Chodron teach it. Just connecting with our basic Buddha nature. And we can maintain that connection throughout the meditation or come back to it whenever we remember. And first, bringing to mind the beings who are caught in the hot hells, the hell realms, and first the hot hells, where the ground is flat and made of burning iron. Flames constantly blaze an arm's length in height. Jagged ravines and precipices cut through the landscape. The water in rivers and lakes takes the form of scorching molten metal and boiling salted water. Even the trees are made of scalding iron. Harmful birds, flesh-eating animals, karmic demons, and murderers roam these realms. The fire in the first level of hell burns seven times hotter than ordinary fire, and each lower level is seven times hotter than the one above it. The mind of a hell being is extremely sensitive, stabbed and blinded by feeling. A hell being's body is soft and his or her flesh tender, like that of a newborn baby. Neither body nor mind can tolerate the slightest pain, so suffering in the hell realms is extremely intense. So imagining what the suffering of this realm is like, how terrible it would be to be stuck there, and in response, generating compassion in our heart, like the heartfelt wish to free beings who are stuck in the hot hell realms. Taking a moment to really feel that compassion, to really generate that feeling and that thought. And then doing taking and sending, for all beings who are stuck in the hell realms. Breathing in all the heat, the danger, the inescapability of it, the constant suffering of it, and breathing out all kinds of relief, coolness, and peace, and happiness, awakening. Letting their suffering dissolve into our Buddha nature. Breathing out all the resources that our Buddha nature has that are inexhaustible, that everyone's Buddha nature has, knowing that beings in the hell realms are not aware of this. They're completely stuck, even though they have the same nature. And now, beings in the cold realms, as described by Taranatha. Beings are born in the cold hells because they have the sensation of being burned in a fire, and wishing to cool off, they seek the cold hell as relief. Sadly, there is no relief, because in the cold hells, the ground, mountains, and valleys are snow and ice, slashed with crevices and ravines. Violent, icy winds and snowstorms rage constantly over the landscape. The winds are so cold that they penetrate skin and chill flesh to the very bone. Each of the eight cold hells is seven times colder than the one above it. So again, vividly imagining the suffering of beings trapped in this realm and doing taking and sending for them with the heartfelt wish to free them from this suffering. Breathing in that cold, that frigidness, breathing out warmth, love, compassion, peace, awakening. And now for beings in the hungry ghost realm. Hungry ghosts suffer unbearably and constantly from hunger and thirst. Their mouths are like the eye of a needle, and their bellies are enormous. They are weary and exhausted from their constant vain effort to find sustenance, and their bodies become emaciated from lack of food and drink. From time to time, they see heaps of food from a distance, but when they arrive, there is nothing left, or it is guarded by a multitude of demons. Sometimes they see a great river of water, but when they arrive at the shore, it has dried up, leaving only sand and stones in the riverbed. And again, we can relate to this as just a state of mind that can exist in our own human realm. If they do find something to eat or drink, it is disgusting, like hot coals, pus, or urine, or it burns up the inside of their bodies. On top of all this, lacking clothing, they are at the mercy of the elements. In the winter, even sunlight feels icy. In summer, even moonlight feels like flames. Raindrops are like hot coals scorching their skin. Flames leap from the 360 dislocated joints in their bodies. Furthermore, seeing each other as enemies, they catch, find, beat, and stab one another and are constantly in fear of being similarly attacked and killed. Because they are naturally timid and fearful, even when there's no threat, they are completely consumed by terror. The duration of the hungry ghost realm is almost as long as that of the hell realms. So again, empathizing, really feeling their suffering, this kind of suffering, and generating the wish to free beings from that kind of suffering, that kind of constant insatiable neediness, constant insatiable feeling of deficiency. We breathe that in, let it dissolve into our vast Buddha nature, which is the same as their vast Buddha nature, and breathe out freedom to them. Breathe out sustenance to them. Breathe out feelings of self-worth. And now the animal realm. Whether they roam the earth's surface, soar through the sky, or are tossed about aimlessly by the waves of the ocean, wild animals prey on one another and live in constant apprehension of being chased and eaten by a predator. This is something we can observe ourselves in the animal realms, and we also know what it feels like. Perhaps we've experienced this in dreams. Domestic animals are not necessarily better off being shorn, pierced, branded, beaten, and forced to carry heavy loads. They may endure the suffering and fear of being enslaved or killed for their meat, blood, skin, and bones. Animals also experience hunger, thirst, heat, and cold, comparable to the suffering of the hell and hungry ghost realms. So vividly imagining all beings in the animal realm, in the oceans, on the land, and in the sky. We breathe in that suffering, that fear of being killed and eaten, that fear of not finding food, that negative karma of having to kill for survival, and all their other suffering. And breathing out freedom and awakening. Freedom from fear, freedom from need. If you have any favorite animals in your backyard, you can imagine them in particular. Or the wild animals of other continents that are hunted for their tusks and so forth, taken as trophies. And now the human realm. Humans experience the four great rivers of suffering. Following the suffering of birth, the various sufferings of illness, aging, and death are inevitable. In addition, we have the day-to-day sufferings of seeking what we want but not finding it. And if we do find something, having to protect, guard, and worry about it. The suffering of encountering the unpleasantness of what we don't want, and the suffering of losing those we love or that which we have accumulated. Even if we have not experienced these kinds of suffering yet, we are certain to in the future. So for all the humans with all of their different kinds of suffering, all their varieties of suffering, we generate the wish to free them from it, and we do taking and sending. Including any humans we know who are suffering in particular ways. including humans we don't know very well, encounter just casually, and including humans that drive us crazy, that we'd rather not be with. Including the suffering of change, humans who think everything is just fine and don't know yet that it's going to turn into suffering. Then the jealous gods are the not quite gods, literally the not gods. These not gods are jealous of the splendor of the gods, so their minds are filled with jealousy, and they are constantly ridden with anxiety, trying to catch up. Occasionally, they must fight the gods, but because their merit is weaker, they must endure the suffering of being killed or beaten, sometimes maimed or disabled. They are in a constant state of war, cold war or declared war, and they never win. Pema Chodron likened this to the corporate world. So to anyone caught up in competitiveness, rivalry, needing to be the best, but fearing they're not the best, we generate the wish to free them and do taking and sending. Breathing in what it's like to be caught up in that state of mind. Breathing out freedom. And then finally, the gods' realms. These are characterized by the luxury of obliviousness, according to Pema Chodron. And Taranatha says, even the gods' realms have no real happiness. The lowest gods are attacked by the jealous gods and have to deal with them. All gods are absorbed in pleasure and thus unaware that their lives are being exhausted moment by moment in meaningless pursuits. They have no motivation to engage in positive actions, practice the Dharma, or accumulate any merit. At the end of their lives, the gods experience the intense, unforeseen suffering of realizing they are going to die. Their suffering is like that of a mother camel who has lost her child, a snake carried off by a hawk, a fish writhing on hot sand, or a person in a boat adrift on the vast ocean. Like they know their fate is coming. Because gods have clairvoyance, they are also able to perceive the lower realm where they will be reborn. The resulting mental anguish of all this is even worse than the physical suffering of the three lower realms and lasts for the equivalent of over 10,000 human years. So again, generating compassion for the suffering of God's realm, the God's realm, which is so, for such a long time, masked as pleasure. For the loss that they will inevitably encounter. Breathing it in and breathing out freedom. And for all the humans caught in a God realm-like human realm, having everything they could need or want, but eventually they will lose it and they don't know it. And now just opening up our visualization to include all the six realms again, cumulatively, all sentient beings, whatever kind of suffering each one of them has. The capacity of our Buddha nature is infinite, so we can breathe in all the suffering of every being in all of the six realms. Let it dissolve and breathe out freedom. And take a moment to think that through this practice, all beings are freed from suffering, from all the six realms, completely freed, completely awakened, including ourselves, and rejoicing in that. And then letting go of all visualization and all conceptuality, coming back to rest and open awareness, still in touch with the nature of mind, our own Buddha nature. Just resting. And now coming back to study what lands us in these six realms. So does anybody have any questions or comments before we start the chapter on karma? Okay, John, I'm going to unmute you. You're going to have to do it. Okay, you're unmuted. Oh, no, you're still muted. Okay.
All right. So when we were contemplating the hell realms, I was curious as to, well, if they're going through all this suffering and not dying, how do they die to get out of that realm?
They eventually exhaust the negative karma because the, you know, any karma, negative karma, anything that we may experience is temporary, it's finite, it's based on causes and conditions, what we've done in the past. So eventually it's exhausted and they have another rebirth, hopefully somewhere else. Anybody else? Okay, then we'll go on to the chapter on karma. So I wanted to go back for a second to our previous discussion. Also remind everybody the basic structure of the book. We have the three prerequisites, Buddha nature, precious human existence, and authentic teacher, connection with an authentic teacher. That's what we need in order to set out on the path. And we have set out on the path by learning about the four obstacles to awakening. And let's take a moment, in case you didn't see my email earlier today, a moment to see if we know what those four obstacles are off the top of our head. And if you don't know what those obstacles are, it's good to know them. The obstacles and their antidotes, because that's going to be the first part of the instructions of the Dharma master or the authentic teacher. The next 16 chapters of the book after the three prerequisites is the instructions. And so we've done the antidote to the first obstacle, which is being overly attached to the activities of this life, being too busy to practice the Dharma, understanding impermanence, how limited our time is, how things are disintegrating moment by moment is our impetus to not take it so seriously. Not get so involved that we have no time to practice. And we've done the second chapter in the instructions of the authentic teacher, which is the sufferings of samsara, thanks to Lama Jinzong over the past two classes. And that's the first antidote to the second obstacle, which is when we're not too busy, losing too much time to distraction and pleasure. And we'll talk more about these in the context of karma. Karma is the second antidote to being too caught up in pleasure and distraction when we do have free time. So we ended last week's discussion talking about whether there were any, as I understood it, and this is one of the aspects anyway of John's question that was addressed, whether there are any universal truths that everybody agrees on. And we had a fair amount of back and forth about that. But at the end, someone, I can't remember who it was, reminded us of the most basic sort of principle of Buddhism, that everybody, all beings want to be happy and they don't want suffering. And that's how the Dalai Lama, like when you see him explaining Buddhism to someone who doesn't have a background in it, that seems to be the first thing he always says. If we can just understand everybody just like us wants to be happy and wants to avoid suffering. So the Buddha said that, like, our actions, like as ordinary beings who are deluded, our actions are driven by ego clinging and, you know, emotional afflictions or obscuring emotions, anger, desire, jealousy, and so forth. And so even though everything we do is with the intention of making ourselves happy, it tends to have the opposite effect. If not in the moment, then if it's a negative action motivated by an emotional affliction, it's going to create karma that's going to result in our suffering in the future. So much of what we do takes us in the opposite direction of where we want to be. So the chapter on karma is like instructions on how to turn that around and engage in actions that do create happiness, that move us towards that goal of being happy and not having suffering, and also helping others do the same. There's more to be said about that. If you remember in the 37 practices, the three levels of motivation for practice, that's the lowest level of motivation, is wanting to avoid suffering. But that tends to be what first gets our attention. You know, that's what first makes us want to set out on the path, is that we want to avoid the suffering that we have now and more suffering in the future. There's a third category besides, you know, creating happiness or creating suffering, and that is creating liberation for ourselves, which is the second. That's verse 9 from the 37 practices. Liberating ourselves from samsara, because we recognize that even what we experience as happiness or pleasure is fleeting and is suffering in disguise. So in the context of Ornament of Precious Liberation, karma is also presented as the antidote to the second obstacle to awakening, of getting too caught up in pleasure and distraction. So with that, we're going to turn first briefly to Gampopa, Ornament of Precious Liberation. I don't have page numbers for the for other versions of the book, but we're on the first page of the Karma chapter, Karma and Its Effects, chapter 6. And in this edition, in this translation, it's page 77. So we're just going to briefly look at it's an overview of the topic of karma, according to Gampopa. So he starts out by saying, if you wonder what causes the sufferings described above, understand them to arise from tainted karma, meaning actions. And I'm just going to skip around. I'm not going to read everything here. I'm going down a little bit to the White Lotus of Great Compassion Sutra, which says, the worlds have been made by actions. Their manifestation is due to actions. Sentient beings have been created by actions and have sprung from actions. Through action arises all their different types. And the word karma means action. And then down a little further, if you wonder what exactly karma is, know that it falls into two areas, mental activity and activity set in motion by thought. And we're going to see this again in Ringu Tulku very shortly. So two types of karma. And then further down at the bottom of the page, karma is intention, and it is also what is done because of that. So I'm going to wait to explain that further until we get to Ringu Tulku, but there's a little bit more on page 78, about the second paragraph down. So harking back to karma is intention, that's number one, and what is done because of that, it's intention and action. Gampopa says, you may wonder what these two actually are. Mental activity, the first category, means the actions of mind. That which is done means whatever physical and verbal activity has been intended and provoked by mind. So again, we're going to talk about this more in a minute with Ringu Tulku. And I just want to end this segment with what's in bold type in Ornament of Precious Liberation. It's the list of 6 points or topics. As you know, every chapter begins with a list of the topics. It's like a little outline of what Gampopa is going to address. And here it's first their categories of actions. Actions and their consequences are summed up through 6 points or topics. Their categories, their characteristics, their ownership, their apportionment, their inflation, and their ineluctability. That is not a word that you encounter very often. If you don't happen to know that word, it means inevitability, or that you can't escape it. You know, you can't escape the consequences of your actions. But we'll get into that next week when we get further into the chapter. Today, we're going to cover the first topic, categories, and at least some of the second topic, characteristics of each category. And it's absolutely fabulous reading. But for now, right now, we're going to go to Ringu Tulku. And we are on page 44, Understanding Karma. So he says, the 3 forms of suffering mentioned in the preceding chapter are the fruit of karma. They're the result of karma. The 3 forms of suffering. So, pop quiz, does everybody know what the 3 forms of suffering are, or the 3 types of suffering? And I imagine everybody does. If it happens that you don't, you're not going to become enlightened. You're not going to wake up. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. You need to know what the 3 types of suffering are. And basically that is that just as much as when we're actually in pain, when we're enjoying life is also suffering. That's what you need to know in order to free yourself from samsara. If you don't get that, you're just not going to be able to push through, because you're going to get caught up in obstacle number 2, pleasure and distraction. So this is where it's an antidote. This is the antidote to obstacle number 2, is understanding that even the good stuff in samsaric life, in the samsaric mentality, even the good stuff is suffering, and you need to free yourself from the good stuff. I think it's easiest to understand, say, in the realm of addiction, where it just feels like you must have it, and it feels so good at the beginning. We could think of ice cream, that first pint, really, really good. And then it's all suffering after that. And it gets you into so much trouble. And the problem with not fully understanding that is that you fall into the same trap again and again and again and again. You can't help it, because you just don't get it enough that you can get like the tremendous impetus that is needed to overcome that impulse to eat the ice cream. And, you know, not just with addiction, but really with all of our habitual patterns, it's the same problem. We don't understand deeply enough that it's going to lead to suffering to really have the motivation to free ourselves in that moment and just not do the thing. So please know the 3 types of suffering. Like, you should be able to recite them in your sleep: the suffering, the suffering of change, and the all-pervasive suffering of conditioned existence. You could think of that, to sort of oversimplify it, you could think the suffering, the suffering of change, and the suffering that everything is falling apart, or the suffering of impermanence, you could say. That's just one way to explain the 3rd kind, but I think that would do the job. So back to Ringu Tulku. So the 3 forms of suffering mentioned in the preceding chapter are the fruit of karma. We suffer. Each of those 3 kinds of suffering comes about because of actions, past actions. The 100 Karmas Sutra explains how the different types of karma create the great variety of living beings. According to Buddhism, everything is created by karma. Nothing is the creation of an all-powerful being. Everything we do produces its own effect, its own result. No super being or God is pleased or displeased with what we do and rewards or punishes our positive or negative actions. For those in the 12 Links class, we just had Trungpa Rinpoche talking about making the exact same point. Basically, when things go wrong, like if you understand karma, there is nobody to complain to. There's nobody to say this is unfair to, because you accept that it's the natural result of causes and conditions created by actions in the past. The law of karma, which is actually the law of interdependence, can be stated this way. Everything we do will have consequences. A positive action will have positive results. A negative action will have negative results. Nothing and no one decides to reward or punish us. It is the force of the action itself that brings about the corresponding result. So that's the first thing that he refers to as the law of karma. And it's very similar to the way it was expressed in The Torch of Certainty, which I'm going to bring in a little bit later. So I'm going to skip the next bit. We're on to page 45, second paragraph. In fact, none of us behaves completely. What comes before that I'm skipping is an amusing classic anecdote, so you can enjoy reading it. Hopefully everybody already has. So in fact, none of us behaves completely positively or negatively. Our behavior, our karmas, meaning our actions, are composed of so many mismatched elements all bound up together, the negative with the positive, and the results are also extremely complex. In Torch of Certainty, Jamgon Kongtrul talks a bit about this, like mixed karma. Like you did something really bad trying to do something really good, or maybe you did something really good trying to do something really bad, and every possible gradation and variation of that combination. Back to Rinku Tulku, it is said that each of the colors of a peacock's feather has its own karmic cause. Only a fully realized being is able to determine precisely what is the cause of what. No one acts in a totally positive or negative way, and therefore the fruits or the results that we harvest are mixed. And that is, most of us have been on the Dharma path and so are familiar with this, with the karma chapter in Torch of Certainty. I'm just going to read this little bit from the Torch, this translation of Torch of Certainty, the Torch of True Meaning. And I'm on page 15. It's the introductory paragraph on karma. And it says the same thing as Rinku Tulku, but I just think it's really helpful sometimes to see how interrelated all of our sources are. So Jamgon Kongtrul says, karmic cause and effect is the fundamental meaning of all the infinite Dharma teachings given by the Buddha. This topic is so incredibly profound and vast that until one has reached one, realized one taste, and that's a high level of realization. Until you get to that high level of realization, you will not fully comprehend it. Though ordinary beings cannot fully appreciate it, karmic cause and effect can be roughly summarized thus. Virtuous causes produce pleasant results, and unvirtuous causes produce painful results. Same thing Rinku Tulku just said. Jamgon Kongtrul also said it. So back to page 45, we're now on the third paragraph. The notion of karma is often misunderstood and confused with fatalism, the passive acceptance of our destiny. Karma is then seen as a force pulling us along like a bale of straw on the ocean of life. I think that's a funny image. Sort of like the blind turtle. I wonder how many lifetimes it will take for the blind turtle to encounter the straw bale. anyway, the idea is that like there's some people think that karma means you have no agency, like everything that happens to you is completely predetermined. It's not like that, is what Rinku Tulku is saying here. He says, however, this is not the Buddhist theory of karma, which is not completely deterministic, but much more dynamic. And he's going to explain how it's more dynamic. And everybody who's been studying the 12 links, this is going to be very familiar. The law of karma is nothing other than the law of interdependence, of conditioned arising. As was explained in the previous section, what we are now is the result of our past, of the karma that we have accumulated. The force of this karma shaped us and set the limits of what we are now. And everybody who's been doing the 12 links class, you know which links we're talking about. That explains why we are not always able to accomplish what we would like to. Of course, we are limited, but within the form and the space that is ours, we have the choice to act in a certain way or not. Our future is in our hands now. What we do now will create our future. So going back a sentence to, we have the choice to act in a certain way or not. If you've been studying the 12 links, we're talking about links 8, 9, and 10, where you first, something feels good in link 7, or it feels bad, and in link 8, you want it or you want to get rid of it. Like that's where we first really get into trouble. And then in the next link, link 9, we decide to go after it. We figure out how we're going to go after it, or how we're going to avoid it or get rid of it. We could stop there. And then in the 10th link, we actually act on it. And that's where we create the karma. We could stop. We could catch ourselves about to do that and not do it. So this is what he's talking about. Within the form and the space that is ours, we have the choice to act in a certain way or not. Our future is in our hands now. What we do now will create our future. This is the law of karma. So this is the second time he says this is the law of karma, slightly different, you know, aspect of karma. Each person has his or her own karma, or to be more exact, each person is his or her own karma. I think that there's a phrase like this body of fully matured karma. You know, our physical body, everything about us is the result of our karma. Or as he says now, it is our, it's like you can see your own karma. You just look in the mirror. You just experience your own body and your own life. And that is like your karma given physical form. So in addition to personal, I'm not going to read the collective karma paragraph, just to save that tiny bit of time, because what we're focusing on here now is personal karma. That's more like just theoretical. It's interesting, but he doesn't really provide a lot of information about it, just acknowledges that there's also a collective karma where we all have certain experiences in common. Anybody have any questions or comments up to now? Okay, I'm going to, whoops, I have to move my, I have my keyboard covered up. Okay, Marilyn.
I'm very interested in the linking of the 12 links with the idea of intention and action that are expressed in Gampopa, or mental activity, I guess. Mm-hmm. Once he describes it as intention, or at least the translator does, but it's mental activity and mentally motivated action. And I'm sort of interested in, we had a discussion, I can't even remember in which class, and I don't know whether John brought it up or not, but about, can you create karma if you haven't actually done anything?
I think that was Patrick who asked that. That was Patrick's question. And the answer is yes. And we're going to get so much more information about that in this very class. That's what this class is actually about today. Yes, mental, like thoughts. Remember that the last three of the 10 negative actions are purely mental actions.
Yeah.
So yes, we're actually, like, this next section of Ringotulka is also going to tie in with what Gampopa said just there that we read and explain it a little bit more. So come back to that question if you don't feel like it's, you know, it becomes clearer in this, as we, in this discussion. Anybody else have anything? Okay. All right. I don't see any hands up. So I'm going to go on with Ringotulku. How do we accumulate karma? And this is exactly correspondent to the section that we read about intention is mental activity, and what it generates is physical and verbal activity, that there are two categories of karma. So he says, we accumulate karma by the law of cause and effect, or action-reaction. According to the Abhidharma Kosha, there are two types of action, two facets of accumulation of karma, which in Tibetan we call sempele and sampele. And basically the first one means intention and the second one means action based on that intention. The first factor, sempele, is the activity of mind, thought, and intention. Sempele means thinking without acting. I think that's a little bit like of an unclear expression there. It means thinking that has not been translated yet into actual physical or verbal action, just at the thought level. Actually, each action begins in our mind. And I can just see Lamanorla Rinpoche making that point again and again, like the mind is the king and the, you know, the body and the speech are the servants of the mind. Without an initial thought, no action is possible. This is the karma of the mind, of motivation. We do not put it into action, but the motivation is already there, or we have not yet put it into action, but the motivation is there. That's like the first factor. The second factor, sampele, means putting the thought into action either physically or verbally. These different categories of deeds can have three sorts of effects: positive, negative, or neutral karma. And we're gonna, that's the next section of Gompopa. This is, if you remember, he gave us six points or six topics, and the first one was the category. So this is the categories of karma section. Positive, negative, or neutral karma, those are the categories. It's actually not exactly the same as Gompopa here, but we're going to talk about that. Negative karma is the result of a truly harmful act, such as killing, lying, or stealing. We speak of the 10 harmful actions, which are among the main causes of negative karma. Positive karma, the second category of karma, is the product of good actions, like giving, protecting life, leading a virtuous life, and so forth. Neutral karma, Rinku Tulku's third category, springs from our inaction, as when we sleep or when we are in samadhi, meaning a meditative state. We don't create any karma then, either negative or positive. So that's where it overlaps with Gompopa's three categories, which are on page 78, which we're about to turn to. He says, first are its categories, the first of the six topics. First category is non-virtuous actions and their effects. Second is virtuous actions and their effects. And the third is what he calls the action of unwavering karma and its effect. So where Rinku Tulku talks about neutral karma also being like when we're sleeping and so forth, Gompopa is not addressing that. He's just addressing meditative karma. That's the karma of meditation, like of actually being in a meditative state. And it's called unwavering karma. In different translations, it's called unmoving karma or the karma of stillness. That's what Kala Rinpoche calls it in his writings, or what his translator calls it, Ken MacLeod, unwavering karma. But it means karma of meditation. And we're actually, I don't know that we'll get to it today. We probably won't, but we are going to look at Kala Rinpoche and Luminous Mind has a short chapter on that, which I had never noticed before. And it's actually really illuminating. But anyway, so that's the takeaway from this is the three kinds of karma. The two components of any karmic act, the mental intention and the physical or verbal action. And then the three categories of karma, positive, negative, and neutral or meditative karma. So now we're not going to go back to Rinku Tulku again today. We are actually going to explore in detail the 10 unvirtuous actions, like more detail than I don't usually teach all of it. I don't usually teach the results type because it's a little bit complicated and sort of beyond the scope, I think, of like where we are at with our understanding and ability to make use of these teachings about karma. But today we're going to look at that. So we've completed the first of the 6 points, the categories, negative, positive, and neutral or meditative karma. The second point, we're on page 78 in Gompopa now. The second point concerns the characteristics of these three. So the longest section here, the first section, which we may get through, is the 10 unvirtuous actions. And that's the most important one to understand. This is what we need to avoid. These are the basic categories we need to avoid. Like there's many, many kinds of actions that we engage in, fully negative, fully positive, somewhere in between. But these are like, this is like the umbrella. If you could avoid these 10 things, you'd be like, that'd be very good. And there may be some things that don't clearly fit into one of the categories. when we do our best. But these 10 categories of negative action are the things that we absolutely want to avoid as much as possible. So non-virtuous actions and their effects. Although generally speaking, there are very many sorts of non-virtuous actions, they can be summarized as the 10 non-virtues. Three are physical, killing, and so forth. And we're gonna get all 10 of them. This is just like the introduction. Three are physical, killing, etc. Four are verbal, lying, etc. And three are mental, avarice or greed, and etc. So here's a partial answer to Marilyn's question. It is clear from this that some karma can just be mental karma. Each of these is itself treated through 3 points. It's categories. Like, what are the categories of body, speech, and mind karma? Its results, the results of each of the negative actions, and some particular instances. So first, killing. Killing has 3 categories. Killing through desire and attachment, killing through anger and aversion, and killing through confused ignorance. And this is one of the things I love about Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism. I love the lists. I love the categories. Like, they cover all the bases. Nothing is really left unacknowledged or left to chance. So are there any acts of killing that would not fall into one of these categories? That's something we could ponder. But so we have killing through desire and attachment to get something you want. Killing through anger and aversion to get rid of something you don't want, and killing through confused ignorance. The first of these is to kill for the sake of meat, hides, and so forth. So they're talking food and, you know, and possessions here. For sport or financial gain, or to safeguard yourself or your loved ones. That's killing through desire and attachment. The second, to kill through anger and aversion, is to murder those you feel aversion for on account of grudges or competition and the like. And the third is done in order to make offerings. And we touched on that last week as well in response to John's question. Lama Jinzong was talking about, you know, the differences in sort of value systems or right and wrong belief in, like, what is right and what is wrong amongst different cultures, and that there are some cultures in which sacrificing life as offerings is considered a good thing, and Buddhism does not, you know, fall into that category. So that's here, it falls into the category of killing through confused ignorance. So it's considered completely wrong in Buddhism. The results of kill. So now the results. So those are the categories of killing. The results of killing are also threefold. The ripened result, the result corresponding to the cause, and the dominant result. And there's different translations for each of these categories in different books. We're going to go with these, except that I really, as we see what it is, that third category, Ken MacLeod translates not as dominant, the dominant result, but as the environmental result. And I don't know what the Tibetan word is because I haven't looked it up, but it is all sort of like, it's about what kind of environment you're born into. So I really like that translation. So for killing, the ripened result is rebirth as a hell being. Killing gives you karma to be reborn in hell. The result corresponding to the cause, which in some translation is called a similar result, I think that's what Ringu Tulku calls it, is that if you are reborn human, you will have a short life and many sicknesses. Like, that's sort of what we would call, what would we call that? Poetic justice, maybe. Like, you kill somebody, you have a short life in your next lifetime. And you're ill all the time. You just have a crappy life. And then the dominant or environmental result is to be reborn in an ill-fated and unattractive land. You're just, well, think of, like, the ultimate ill-fated and unattractive land would be Taranatha's description of the hell realms, right? Where everything is molten and, you know, burns you and so forth. So, and the particular instance, the most heinous among all forms of killing, we could call it the worst case, is to kill an arhat who is also your father. a realized being who happens to also be your father. And both of those are among the five actions of immediate consequence, where you just go straight to the hell realm. Like no bardo, no nothing. You just die and you're gone. You're in hell. Killing an arhat and killing your father, killing a realized being, killing your father. So this is a combination of two of those. So does anybody have any questions or comments before we go on to stealing? Is this, I mean, I think this is a very clear presentation. Dave, I'm unmuting you.
You asked if there's a category of killing not covered, and I was noticing there's nothing said about like incidental killing, stepping on a bug by accident that you don't know is there.
Yeah, that's true. I think that that's dealt with. I think that here in the 10 unvirtuous actions, like intentionality is always part of the equation. And I think that unintentionally engaging in a negative action is in a different category, where like that determines the intensity of the karmic result as opposed to the nature of the karmic result. So when we step on a bug, obviously the karma is not going to be as strong, but I think that there is some karma. There's some karmic result for an unintentional action, but the intensity of it is less. And Lama Jinzong has something to say here. You're unmuted.
Sorry, I had to lie down. That's why. Yes. Sorry, my back.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Some karma.
That's yeah. There you go.
Something you did, Lama Jinzong.
I beat up a lot of horrible. But Lama Nyingma Rinpoche, that's one of the reasons he never learned to drive, because the idea is, of course, why during Nyingma's you're not supposed to drive, because you unintentionally kill bugs. So you know, and that's also why Taisa Jarimpoche used to say like that vegetarians can't get all self-righteous about the fact that, you know, well, I don't kill animals to eat, because in the flooding of the rice paddies, zillions of bugs are always killed. So, you know, they say that just because of the karma of having taken a form, a human form, and needing food, you have the activity, you know, you have the karma of killing regardless of its being intentional or unintentional. You know, that's part of the karma of being born in a form that requires food.
Yes, thank you. That's really helpful. And I remember Lama Nyingma Rinpoche also saying, like, you can't avoid killing if you eat, if you wear clothes, or if you take medicine, because beings are killed to make any of those things possible for us. So yeah, so that's very helpful. And I see that Marilyn has her hand up. Thank you, Lama Jinzong.
I have heard an explanation of the third type of suffering, not as the coming together and falling apart part, but of what we were just talking about.
Yeah, Patril Rinpoche, Words of My Perfect Teacher, has a beautiful passage on, he explains the suffering of conditioned existence as that everything we enjoy in our life, everything that comes to us comes through someone else's suffering. And he talks about how you can't have tea, like to get tea to you involves, so he goes through all the levels of suffering, from the bugs that are killed on the tea plants to the people who have to transport, and the animals that have to transport the tea and so forth. And he also, I think, like clothing, like wool, like all the suffering that goes into making wool available. Yes, thank you for bringing that into it. Anything else, Marilyn? Anybody else? Okay, then we will go on to stealing. But clearly, what Jamgon Kongtrul and Rinpo Tulku said at the outset of this chapter is something to bear in mind, that karma is so complicated. It has so many factors and so many gradations that you really don't want to put your mental energy too much into trying to figure it out, but just go with the basic law of karma. Do good things, you get happiness. Do bad things, you get suffering. And that's sort of all we need to know. But yet we're being given all this information, so it's good to contemplate it, you know, to some extent, without getting too caught up in thinking that we might figure it all out. So stealing has three categories: stealing by force, stealing by stealth, and stealing through cheating or fraudulence. The first of these is to steal with needless violence. The second, to steal unnoticed by burglary and the like. And the third is to cheat through corrupt weights and measures. And I remember, like, maybe the first time I heard Lama Nyingma Rinpoche teach this text many, many years ago, and he didn't have translators. back then, so it was so hard to convey the meaning of some things. And this third one, cheating through corrupt weights and measures, he was like trying to, like, you know, demonstrate a scale, and like nobody was getting what he was talking about. Now we understand. We have translators. We have fabulous translations. But that's always stuck in my memory. Like the cheating. Like cheating is one of the factors of stealing, because weights and measures. You know, you fix the scale. You know, I forget what the word is, but you adjust the scale so that it's not accurate. So of the three types of result. The result of stealing is rebirth as a hungry ghost. We know that, right? Oops, I lost my place. The result corresponding to the cause is that even if reborn human, you experience poverty. That's the poetic justice result. And the dominant or environmental result is to be reborn in a place where there is much frost and hail, unfriendly environment, being pelted with things. The worst case of stealing, the most pernicious act, is to take wealth belonging to your guru or to the three precious refuges. Do not steal, you know, from a sacred place. Any questions on stealing or comments on stealing? All right, this is all fairly straightforward. Did I hear something? No, everyone's muted. Okay, so sexual misconduct, we're actually going to skip over a lot of that because it's culturally based and, you know, not really doesn't apply, but sexual misconduct has three categories. Sex proscribed by family ties. We have that. Cousins do not marry, right? Bad result. Sex proscribed by belonging to someone else. We don't take somebody else's partner. And sex proscribed due to religious factors. I think we're just going to skip over all the specifics because they are largely cultural. I mean, some of them apply in our culture too. But mostly the way that I've heard it expressed is to just avoid harm, avoid any sexual activity that causes harm to another person. And we usually know, like we usually know beforehand. So on to the result. The result of sexual misconduct is rebirth as a hungry ghost. So this also gets you the hungry ghost rebirth. The corresponding or poetic justice result is that even if reborn human, your partner will be like a hateful enemy. The dominant result is to be reborn in a very dusty land. The worst case is the pernicious act of having intercourse with your own mother who happens to be an Arhat. I'm sure that's not funny if it happens. But it's like, that's like the Greek tragedy, you know, aspect. All right, so now on. So those are the three physical negative actions, three, you know, big ones. So now on to the four negative actions of speech. Lying is of three types. And this is one that there's always, like, questions. There's always, like, well, what about this? What about the white lie? You know, what if you're lying in order to preserve someone's self-worth? I think that there's a lot of gray areas in lying, like maybe more than anywhere else. So we'll see what Gampopa has to say. Lying is of three types. Lies that are your undoing, big lies, and trivial lies. The first of these are those of false gurus and involve pretense about spiritual accomplishment. The second are lies told with the intention to benefit oneself or to harm others. That's probably the most common category of lie that we will deal with in our own conduct. And the third are lies that are neither beneficial nor harmful. So anything that's listed here is considered a negative action that results in negative consequences. So lies that are neither beneficial nor harmful, maybe that white lie falls into that. You know, like, no, that doesn't make you look fat. It's a really lovely haircut. Those lies that we tell all the time, there might be a little karmic consequence there. I think we just have to weigh those things for ourselves and then confess. I told him he didn't look fat. I'm sorry. I'm never going to do it again. I take refuge in the three jewels. Om Benza Sato Hung. So on to the results. Lies are just hard to sort out sometimes, but most of the time we know we know that we're lying to protect ourselves or make ourselves look better, or lying to get someone else in trouble. Those are the ones you really want to be careful about. And then I think with the gray areas, we just do our best to figure out the calculus of the cost-benefit ratio. And maybe every once in a while, it will seem like the best thing to tell a little harmless lie that doesn't hurt anybody. But I think if we can avoid it, we try to avoid it. So on to the results of lying. The ripened result is rebirth as an animal. The corresponding result is that even if, and I wonder about that, like lying is a kind of sort of enforced ignorance. Like you're enforcing like an incorrect view of something, an inaccurate view. To me, that like makes sense that it would, you know, you're adding to confusion. So it makes sense that it would be reborn, you'd be reborn as an animal. The corresponding or poetic result is that even if born human, you are denigrated by others. The dominant or environmental result is to have bad breath. Makes sense. That's almost a poetic result too. I think that falls into poetic results. And the worst case is the pernicious act of lying to your guru when you have slandered the Tathagata. What I've mostly heard in practical terms for us, I don't know that we would be slandering the Tathagata, the Buddha basically. We wouldn't be saying bad things about him. But if you lie about your spiritual practice to your teacher, that's how I've heard it expressed most of the times I've been taught this text. So be honest with your teacher about your spiritual practice, because otherwise they can't help you. So any questions so far? We have three more speech categories. All right, divisive speech. So lying is the first negative action of speech. Second, divisive speech of three types: vehement, insinuated, or via third parties. I'm not sure vehement is the best, you know, it's sort of like outright, like turning people against each other, because that's what divisive speech is. You make someone think badly of another person, or you put a wedge between two people or two groups of people. So like doing it outright, like, you know, just saying something nasty, insinuated, like saying something nice, but in a way that the person gets the message you're trying to get across. And then via a third party, indirectly. So we can't get away with it. There's like no cover here. There's no way we can get away with divisive speech. So we really have to watch that. The first, the vehement or outright, separates friends by direct slander. The second separates them through insinuations made in their presence. And the third does so through rumors. Don't start rumors. And then the result, the ripened result, is rebirth in hell. So like killing, divisive speech sends you to hell. The corresponding result or poetic result is that even if you are reborn human, you will be separated from friends. There will be a gulf between you and the people you want to be friends with. And the environmental or dominant result is birth in a place where the landscape is erratic and dangerous. And the worst case is the pernicious act of causing a schism in the Sangha. So on to wounding speech, most commonly known as harsh speech, or basically critical speech, is of three types: direct, insinuated, or via third party. Oh, that's, whoops, right. Wounded, yeah, same thing. Did I read it the wrong thing? Yep, same thing, same. I read this before, but I didn't remember that they were the same categories. All right, same. Direct, insinuated, or via third parties. The first is to tell some, so directly harsh speech is to tell someone openly of their faults and weaknesses. Insinuated harsh speech means to say hurtful things in a half-disguised manner mingled with jest relevant to someone present, basically using jokes to wound somebody. And then the third, via third parties, is to gossip about someone's faults or weaknesses to their friends and third parties. So we're going to have to read this a few times, right, to really retain all of this information, because our habits are so strong that we're very likely to forget it as soon as you close the book and go out and engage again in the same patterns. But it's really worth getting like at least the major categories. You don't have to necessarily remember the results. All right, the fourth type of negative speech is useless speech or meaningless speech. Three types: deluded useless speech, useless worldly chatter, and true but useless speech. The first concerns the formulas and recitations of deluded belief systems. The second concerns silly talk jokes and the like. That's the one we usually think of. That's the main one, just wasting our speech. And then the third concerns attempts to explain Dharma to those lacking respect or an appropriate frame of mind. Yes, to like an unreceptive audience who perhaps is just going to develop worse and worse ideas about Buddhism if you try to explain things to them, or just get like misconceptions from it. So you have to know who you're talking to when you share Buddha Dharma. So the results, rebirth as an animal again. Corresponding result is that even if reborn a human, your words will carry no weight. No one will believe you. And the dominant result is rebirth in a place where the seasons are completely erratic. That made me think, like, what did we all do to be reborn in climate change? There might be. And also the other thing I thought of is how full the world is of useless chatter, of all kinds of like, you know, negative, but especially useless and meaningless speech, like 24-hour news channels and so forth. It's just, so we won't go there in terms of trying to figure out how that might be related, but let's see. And the worst case, the most pernicious kind of useless speech is that which distracts those who are practicing Dharma. So now we're on, those are the four negative actions of speech. Now we're on to the mental, the purely mental actions. And the first one is called avarice. I've most often seen it translated as covetousness. Avarice is of three types. Avarice concerning your own things. Avarice concerning other people's things and those things that belong to neither you nor others. So the first, and I didn't remember this one. This is one I had forgotten. I really only think of covetousness as coveting what somebody else has that you want. But it also applies to your own things and your own qualities. So the first is a grasping attachment to family status, physical appearance, qualities, wealth, and possessions, thinking, there is no one quite like me. I am the best. So that's one that I need to watch out for because I haven't paid attention to that one. But the second one, we all know, is to covet the good things that others possess, thinking, if only this were mine. And then if we kill the person to get it, that is the first category of killing through desire and attachment. The third involves attachment to things that belong to no one. I'm not sure there's anything left that belongs to no one. There used to be in old Tibet, but such as the precious substances buried in the earth. Thinking, if only I could own that. Of the three types of result of avarice or covetousness, the ripened result is to be reborn as a hungry spirit. That makes sense. And maybe that's why we see it as like as greed. See, it's desire and it's also greed. Why is it both of them? Because this is greed. The corresponding result or poetic result is that even if reborn human, avarice will dominate the mind. That's like the psychological aspect of the hungry ghost realm, always needing or wanting more than you have. The environmental result is rebirth in a place where the quality of food is poor, and we all know about the food in the hungry ghost realm. When they do find it, it's really horrible. And of all the sorts of avarice, the most pernicious is the wish to steal the possessions of those who have truly renounced the world. Of course, since they've truly renounced the world, they won't care, but it's still bad to take them or to not take them. We haven't taken them yet. We didn't get to stealing, but we're just coveting right now. All right, second one is malevolence, also known as ill will, due to hatred, jealousy, or resentment. So those are the three categories. The first, due to hatred, is to contemplate killing another because of hatred, as happens in times of war. So Marilyn, I think this is getting to the gist of your question. Like malevolence is having perhaps the desire to kill somebody, but not necessarily acting on it, but simply having that strong desire is a negative action in itself. The second, due to jealousy, is due to competition and the like, is to think about killing or harming another through fear of being surpassed. And that brings to mind, I don't know if anybody remembers or was aware of the Texas cheerleader killing of like a couple of decades ago, when the mother of a Texas high school cheerleader killed, like she paid a hitman to kill another cheerleader because she was better than her daughter and she wanted her daughter to be the best cheerleader. Like that's exactly this. There's a category for that. The third, due to long-standing resentment, is to contemplate killing or hurting someone who has previously wronged one or the like. And jumping ahead to Gampopa's chapter on patience, you know, there are three ways that he tells us to be patient. One is just not to be bothered, but if we can't manage that one, don't react, like don't retaliate. And the third one is don't hold a grudge. And we see now, like, why we don't want to hold a grudge, because if you hold a grudge, you're always poised to engage in a negative action, to wish them harm, or to outright kill them. So of the three types of result of malevolence, the ripened result is rebirth in hell. Corresponding result is that even if reborn human, hatred dominates your mind. And the dominant result or environmental result is rebirth in a place where the food is bitter and coarse, as opposed to just not very good. Of all types of malevolence, the worst instance and the most pernicious act is to plan to commit one of the five acts that have an immediate consequence. And what are those? Those are killing your mother, killing your father, killing an arhat, I think is one of them, creating a schism in the sangha, and like wounding or drawing blood from a Tathagata, from a Buddha. Anybody remember them differently? So those are ones you want to avoid at all costs. Don't do those things. No Greek tragedy kind of scenarios, because you go straight to hell. Immediate consequence means no bardo. It's that bad. All right, we're on to the last one. This will be the last thing we cover today, but it's more than I thought we would probably cover. Aberrant belief, also known as wrong view, also a mental, this is the last of the mental negative actions. Three types: aberrant beliefs about actions and their consequences, about the truths, and about the precious refuges. So the first of these means not believing that virtuous and non-virtuous actions produce their respective consequences, happiness and suffering. So basically not believing in karma. That's a wrong view. It's so wrong that it's actually a negative action that incurs negative karma. And you can see, like, it would probably incur negative karma, because if you don't believe in karma, then you're going to do negative things. The second wrong view is to consider that the truth of cessation will not be obtained through practice of the truth of the path, that you can't liberate yourself from suffering from samsara through practice, that the Buddha's noble truths were not true. And the third is to deprecate the three precious refuges, believing them to be untrue. So is that all clear? So the results of wrong view: rebirth as an animal, even if reborn human, stupidity and confusion dominate your mind. You've just dug yourself further and further into ignorance. And the worst and the dominant result is rebirth in a place without harvests, like no food. The worst instance and most pernicious view among wrong views is to become caught up in the thorn-like view. And I'm not, I don't know why it's called a thorn-like view. I'm sure one could research that, but I looked it up in the footnote, and it means that you don't believe in long-term karma. You just believe in immediate consequences. So like you would think, like, Hitler did not go to hell, or there's no cosmic justice. Like if somebody doesn't get punished in this life for a crime, they're off scot-free. And the Buddha taught otherwise. So it's 3:26. We will stop here. And we'll go on. We'll just continue next week into that. That was like the main slog of the chapter, was all the 10 on virtuous actions. So the virtuous actions are much easier to go through. And we're going to look briefly at the third category of karma, which we don't talk about that often, unwavering karma, or the karma of meditation, which can get you into some trouble, although it's a good path. It's where it's like those four form, the form and formless realms. that are in the one of the later verses of the meditation paramita in the 37 practices in Ngampopa. It's like you don't want to get so caught up in calm abiding meditation, like having a peaceful, calm, blissful mind, that you then don't see through that to ultimate reality. You don't free yourself. You can't free yourself, and you end up in what's called the form and formless realms of meditation. And then the Buddha eventually frees them by letting them know that the path is not complete yet. So we'll see what lands us there. Let me see if I have any other notes. Nope, just going ahead next week. And we'll be using again both Ornament of Precious Liberation and Ringu Tulku next week. Okay, so anybody have any questions or comments? We don't have a lot of time now, but we should have more time for discussion next week if there is any. Anybody have anything now? Marilyn, and then I think Angela and John have their hands up. Yeah, Marilyn.
I'll be very brief, but when I was studying this the first time in the Dharma path and still working, I saw how gossip functions in such an incredibly negative way. And it was really difficult to beat back that habit.
So yeah.
Say, but it was really prevalent.
Yeah. Yes, I too have experienced that. It's really, it's hard to refrain sometimes. I don't know if that's what you're saying, but it can be hard not to get involved in that in certain environments. So let's see. Angela, did you have your hand up? I'm unmuting you.
And Lama Karma taught on the same subject when he was down here this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting when he was saying that virtuous karma leads to less. So that's why we have, when we're on a good path and everything's easy, is when we can be closer to our hearts and get really centered in mm-hmm. that. And how when we have virtuous actions, it creates more. And so it's harder to get through the delusion because mm-hmm. there's so much more there. I just thought it was more interesting to kind of break it down and be like, oh, you want it to be very simple so that I can sort of always maintain a heart path to it.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. So you're like clearing away the obstacles, like virtuous karma clears away all of the obstacles and sidetracks in your path.
Yeah.
That's what he was saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, John, I'm gonna try to unmute you, John, but it doesn't unmute, so I'm gonna let you do it.
Okay, so quick comment was on killing. It wasn't mentioned, but I think it's implied in there. Mm-hmm. Suicide, that would be the direct elevator to hell.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. There's definitely consequences to it. And Lama Norla Rinpoche used to talk about that a lot. Like he said that one of the things he said was that one consequence is that you live out your lifespan basically in the bardo, sort of reliving your suicide again and again and being aware of the suffering that you've caused everyone. We don't have time to get into that too deeply, but I don't know. I mean, killing sends you to hell, so I assume killing yourself would fall into that category. And if you to commit suicide, you are already in psychological hell. So it would make sense that, you know, that would be prolonged. But I don't really know. Thank you. Anybody else have anything? Question or insight? Okay, Fanny.
Hi. What about it seems sardonic. A lot of people sardonic wit, like so in terms of, I mean, that strikes me as deflection and mm-hmm. you know, maybe at the expense of others,
or also the
person's feeling harmed themselves, that they don't want anyone to get too close, but mm-hmm. you really see that a lot. I see that a lot everywhere.
Yeah, I think that falls
joking,
under the...
Joking, but not really joking.
Yeah, that falls under the second category of harsh speech.
Seems to me that's harsh speech.
Yeah, I think that was actually one of the things that was mentioned. I'm just going to go back for the wording, and then we'll do our prayers.
Okay, thank you.
Wounding speech. The second category was to say hurtful things in a half-disguised manner mingled with jest, relevant to someone who is present. That's so in the presence of somebody, you hurt their feelings, basically, but doing it through the guise of a joke. Yeah, sardonic would probably cover that, yeah. Okay, anybody else before we do our prayers? Thank you, Fanny. Okay, so I'm pulling up my prayers. And then next week we will continue karma. We'll complete karma next week. And then the following chapter will be love and compassion, the antidote to the third obstacle of being too focused on personal peace. So let's take a moment to collect our attention and bring our mind to rest. And as we chant the dedication prayers, we will direct our attention to sharing the benefit of this study, contemplation, and meditation with all beings in service of their enlightenment or awakening. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha. This dedication, please fulfill. All right, everybody's unmuted. Hi. See you next week. I hope everybody has a good week.
Hey, are you coming to Kansas City?
Yes, we are. Sometime in May, maybe, or June.
Oh, wow.
Okay, awesome. Okay.